Anna had been beginning to despair when Charles spotted the mobility cart bearing the ranch's logo in silver and brown, parked tightly behind the rows of blue stadium seats. From there, it was easy to find familiar faces. Anna and Charles found seats next to Mateo and Terry, just behind Maggie, Joseph, Max, Chelsea, and Wade. Max twisted around and grinned at Anna. "Maggie is a little tyrant," he said. "She declared that everyone had to see her ride." He raised his voice to a squeak that was supposed to sound like his little sister. "Everybody," he grinned. And then Michael, not to be outdone, declared that we all had to be here to watch him, too. So Dad and Hostine are getting the kids and horses ready for the class so that the rest of the crew can watch from the rail. Anna thought it seemed reasonable to her. Children ought to feel comfortable demanding an audience if they were going to ride in this huge building. The bleachers were empty, but the stadium seating along the arena railing seemed to be pretty full.
"Where's Maggie, then?" Anna asked. "Her class isn't until this afternoon, right?"
"She seems to think that Michael might need some coaching," said Joseph. If his voice was hesitant, the twinkle in his eye wasn't. "Bossing, more like. It's a good thing that boy is laid back. Her cage's household will be hell until they both grow up and go out on their own."
"She's got a good heart," Maggie said, repressively.
Joseph looked at her, and Anna saw that he adored the woman who sat beside him.
"She's just like her grandma," he said, patting her hand. "Tough, straightforward, and determined. You didn't turn out so bad, Maggie, my love. If she's half the woman you are, the world better watch out."
"Joseph," said a stranger who came down the short stretch of stairs until he could stand next to Joseph's chair, which was on the aisle.
"I didn't expect to see you here."
"My grandson's riding," Joseph said with dignity. "Where else would I be?"
And the two men started talking about other days and other shows, horses they'd owned, horses other people had owned. They were joined by an older woman who could have stepped out of the Grand Ole Opry of the 80s. She glittered in gold and black tiger stripes, wore too much makeup, and had a voice that decades of smoking had roughened to Marlene Dietrich level. She was bawdy and made both of the old men laugh. Maggie leaned sideways and added a sharp remark that showed that she, too, was a welcome part of this group. They tried to include Chelsea, and she smiled on cue, but she was noticeably tense in the big, noisy crowd. Anna glanced at Charles, who was watching Chelsea, too. He didn't look worried, so she sat back and looked around. Directly in front of them, a large group of very well-groomed and glittering horses circled the arena at a very, very slow canter. As soon as she started watching them, Charles whispered in her ear, "Half-Arab, Anglo-Arab Western pleasure, amateur owner to ride, section one. This is an elimination round. The best of them will go on to the semifinal round. That's why no one in the audience is too excited about it, except for the cheering sections for each horse and rider."
"They are very slow," she said after a moment. "Shouldn't they be going faster? What if something was chasing them? I think Portobello walked faster than this yesterday. What's an Anglo-Arab?"
"Half thoroughbred, half Arab. It was the first of the half-bred Arabs to gain popularity. The thoroughbred added size so bigger people could ride. These are almost all quarter horse or paint crossbreeds, except for the Appaloosa down there."
He paused.
"That's a really nice Appaloosa."
Joseph, still chatting with his buddies, had apparently been paying attention to them, too.
"Still got the eye. That mare won this class the past 2 years running. If this is a fair sampling of her competition, she's got a good chance of winning it again. If Helen's daughter-in-law doesn't take it with her shining spark gelding."
Anna quit trying to parse the horse talk. For instance, what in the world was a shining spark gelding? And just settled in and watched pretty horses moving very slowly, with pretty riders wearing sometimes garish colors, and lots of glitter. The men were better off than the women,
coming off conservative in comparison. All the while, Anna breathed in deeply, paying attention to what her nose could tell her. Mostly, it told her that at least two people around her were wearing too much perfume, and there were lots and lots of horses around. The riders were called into the center, those advancing to the next level were announced, and then they cleared the ring. Almost instantly, the stadium seats filled, and the nosebleed bleachers saw some use. Joseph and Maggie's gossip partners wandered off to find their seats. Over the loudspeaker, the announcer said, "This is Class 116, lead line ages 2 through 7. First in is Candace Hart riding Little Joe Green by Mr. Vanilla out of Desert Wind Doll with handlers Josie Hart and Karen Tucker." And a tiny girl, who was younger than Michael, came into the ring wearing a tiny pink cowboy outfit that glittered with pink rhinestones under the lights. She wore itty-bitty pink boots and bright pink fringe chaps. She sat on a very small black saddle that looked utterly ridiculous and precious at the same time. Instead of a cowboy hat, she wore a bright pink riding helmet. The horse, a very pale palomino, carried his tiny burden with solemn majesty. The two adults walked on the left side, one holding a lead clipped to the bridle, the other with a hand on the tiny girl's leg. "That is the cutest thing I've ever seen," said Anna, seriously. "Just wait," said Maggie. "It's not over yet." And one at a time, each little rider was announced and led in. There were English riders, Western riders, and one who looked like an extra from The Shake in what the announcer called traditional costume. The costume was a bright-colored flowing thing with enough tassels, jewels, and bangles to leave any self-respecting Bedouin tribesman running for the hills. "Next in, we have Michael Sani on 3-time national champion S.A. Phoenix by Xenophon out of S.A. Rose Queen. Leading them in is Cage Sani." Michael couldn't compete with the little fairy doll in pink. Instead, like some of the men Anna had seen in the last class, he was wearing a perfectly respectable blue western-cut shirt with a black shoestring tie. Like his father and Hosteen, Michael looked very much at home on top of the big bay gelding his father led. When Michael rode past them, he gave his grandfather a solemn nod and patted his horse. Joseph returned the nod, but added a grin as he held up both hands clasped together in the traditional victory sign. When the last rider was in, the announcer asked the group to reverse at a walk. They paraded for about 5 minutes so that everyone had time to take photos, and then they were taken to the middle of the ring. Anna couldn't help a ridiculous twinge of anxiety. Michael looked awesome, but who could compete with a toddler in pink or a princess dressed in tassels on a white horse with a tail that dragged the ground? She clenched Charles's hand, and he clenched her hand back, looking so serious that she knew he was having fun. She had the suspicion that it might be at her expense. "Well, ladies and gentlemen," said the announcer, "our judges have been very impressed with this group this morning. What do you say?" The crowd exploded in a chorus of clapping and whistles. Charles covered Anna's ears to protect them and winced a little. It was loud. Chelsea had covered her own ears. Good for her. When the crowd quieted, the announcer said solemnly, "That's exactly what our judges said. With this quality of competition, they have been unable to pick a clear winner. If this were a race, they'd have to declare it a dead heat. Because of this, we have decided to award first place to every child in the class." More applause followed. Anna sat back and gave Charles an indignant look. "They all get first prize," she said.
"That's right," Charles said.
"Every time?"
"Couldn't you have picked out a winner?"
She smacked his thigh lightly and then rubbed it to wipe away any hint of sting in case she'd hit too hard. When the last child was led out of the ring, Anna gave a happy sigh as the group of Sani stable hands, trainers, and riders stood up and began to shuffle out.
"Joseph and I will watch from here," said Maggie. You should go out and walk around. Mackie's class isn't until just before the lunch break. We'll keep Max here to run for food and drink.
Chapter 13. The arena they had been in, despite its size, was not a tenth of the Scottsdale showgrounds. Their program guy promised them more than 2,000 horses, and Anna supposed that many horses could not be contained in a small area. And Charles was interested in them all. Anna soon gave up watching horses for the pleasure of watching her husband watch the horses. Once in a while, he'd grunt in approval, and she'd know he'd found something he really liked. They stood for a while by a covered arena. There were lots of arenas where people were doing some last-minute training or warming up or whatever. English horses with big shoes trotted rapidly around, lapping the Western horses, whose oh-so-slow gaits seemed almost zen-like. Women riders outnumbered men, but not by a huge margin, except in the 10 to 18-year-old crowd, which seemed to be mostly girls. One horse was foaming with sweat, and his mincing Western gait was stiff and uncomfortable-looking. His rider kept pulling back on the bit and spurring at the same time. Charles grunted and walked away from the arena.
"What was she trying to do?" asked Anna.
"I don't know," Charles said unhappily. "And I can tell you, that poor horse didn't know either."
They stomped for a bunch of young horses, crowded in front of yet another arena, clad only in narrow-banded halters designed to show off their exotic heads. They sidled and snorted and looked pretty. A few of them were frightened. Anna could smell it. Most of them were just bouncing around with happy energy, preening when they noticed someone looking at them. Charles bought Anna an ice cream cone, taking a good-humored lick himself when she offered it to him. And nowhere did they smell Fay. The buildings where the horses were stabled were set in parallel lines along the outer edge of the showgrounds. Some of them were strewn with banners belonging to one stable or another. They found the Sani stables more by luck than because they were looking for them. A crowd of children were gathered around the horse Michael had ridden in the lead line class. He was bare of tack, except for his halter, and stood half asleep while one of the Sani handlers held him so that the children could pet him. Cage stood by the horse's hindquarters, gently directing the kids toward the front of the horse instead of the rear, and patiently answering questions. Mackie seemed to be helping, showing the younger children how to pet gently. She was dressed in a white button-up shirt tucked into dark gray stretch pants that were tucked into tall English riding boots.
"Anna! Anna!"
caroled Michael, breaking free of the crowd and running up to her.
I won! Did you see me?"
She smiled. "I did. Did you have fun?"
"I like riding Nix,"
he said, bouncing happily in a way that reminded her of the bunch of young horses they'd just seen.
"He's Grandpa's horse, and he likes kids. The kids from my school are here. They saw me win, too. I'm letting them pet my horse."
"I see that." Ms. Newman was mostly too busy admiring Cage to look their way, though she managed one sly look at Charles that stopped as soon as Anna caught her eye. Ms. Edison smiled sharply, an aha smile, but didn't leave her post at the rear of the herd of children. Anna didn't know if it was good or bad that the principal had figured out just who had clued them into the trouble at the daycare. None of them, children or teachers, smelled of Fay magic, either. She could smell Ms. Edison's perfume and Ms. Newman's shampoo, and one of the kids had a cat, but she didn't smell Fay. Charles walked them around the kids, nodding to Cage as they passed, and into the stable building. Hosteen was drinking from a bottle of water and chatting with Wade. Beside them, sitting hunched over a straw bale, Chelsea had her eyes closed. Anna left Charles's side and sat down beside Chelsea. She finished the last of her ice cream cone, licked her sticky fingers, and tried to radiate calm. She was rewarded by Chelsea's gradual relaxation, though the other woman didn't open her eyes.
"Too many people," Chelsea murmured. "Too many sounds, too many smells."
"Yeah," Anna agreed. "It
hits all of us like that once in a while. Do you need to go home?
Chelsea shook her head, took a deep breath, and opened her eyes.
Not until after Mackie's class. Then a whole bunch of us will go back to the ranch. All the kids and me will take Nick's, too. He's 28, ancient of days. One day of excitement is enough for him.
How long until Mackie's class?
Anna asked.
Hostein said, about an hour.
Then why don't I wait with you here?
Chelsea smiled tensely, but it was Hostein who said in a gentle voice,
I think that would be very useful. Thank you.
About then, Ms. Edison came into the stables to thank Chelsea for letting the 4-year-old pet Michael's mount. She was smiling, gracious, and brief. Mackie's class was a lot smaller than the lead line class had been. There were 3 girls, one of them nearer to 10 and the other girl about Mackie's age.
This is English pleasure, said Joseph, for Anna's benefit. The horses have more elevated gaits. That means they pick their feet up higher and are generally more excitable. There aren't a lot of horses who can be English pleasure horses and be safe enough for someone under 10 to ride.
The riders rounded the ring at a trot, Haylight looking a lot bigger with Mackie riding him. Anna leaned forward and paid attention. The other younger girl looked a little off balance, and her horse, a sweet-faced chestnut, didn't have the action of the other 2 horses. This time, Anna noticed, the family was tenser than they had been for Michael, leaning forward in their seats. The horses walked for half the arena, reversed, and trotted. Max groaned and Maggie sat up straighter.
Change diagonals, Mackie, she said under her breath. Come on, notice what's going on. Quit paying attention to the crowd and watch what you're doing.
Anna leaned toward Charles in silent query.
When you're posting, you rise and fall with one front leg instead of bouncing with every footfall, Charles said.
It was like music, and Anna understood music.
Like cut time instead of 4-4?
Right. It's easier on the horse and on the rider, but when you're riding in a circle, you want to rise and fall with the outside leg. The inside leg on a circle is already taking more weight.
Mackie is on the wrong leg. She'll have to bounce a beat to change. There she goes. Good girl.
She'll make reserve, said Joseph.
That's just fine. Not the first mistake she's made in the ring, and it won't be the last.
Any class that you end up still on top instead of eating dirt is a good class, said Max, deadpan, but obviously quoting someone.
She's got the hands and the seat, said Maggie, just like her grandfather. She'll be one of the good ones.
If she wants to be, said Chelsea.
She'd come to the stands with Wade, Anna, and Charles to watch while her husband was in the paddock behind the in-gate to make sure Mackie got into and out of her class okay. She was, Anna noticed, doing a lot better with the crowded arena than she had earlier. The hour in the quiet of her section of barn with Anna radiating calm had given her the respite she'd needed to regain her control.
Max laughed. No one is capable of making Mackie do anything she doesn't want to, Mom, you know that.
The riders lined up in the middle and the places were announced. Mackie did indeed take reserve, which apparently was second place. The horses trotted one more time all the way around the arena and then out of the gate. Chelsea stood up as if she had springs.
I'll go gather the children. Max, can you help your grandparents get home when they're ready?
Will do, he said.
Charles got up too.
Let's take a break from the horse show. If there is someone who is Faye here at the showgrounds, we aren't having any luck finding them.
They ended up eating at a Chinese restaurant that was fairly decent, better than anything in Aspen Creek, anyway. It was late for lunch and early for dinner, so there was only one other couple in the place. Charles relaxed and listened in on Anna's phone call with Special Agent Fisher. Leslie sounded frustrated and unhappy. Our expert was in with McDermott for 2 hours this morning, but he wants another crack at him this afternoon. Sorry.
Tell her, Charles said thoughtfully, to see if she can figure out if Mr. McDermott
was gone for a couple of weeks in November, when the Fey all disappeared into the reservations. He shouldn't be one of the ones who hid out like the Weirden in Ms. Jameson's garden. If she's checking the background of the other people associated with the daycare, she should look at that for them, too. When Anna relayed the suggestion, Leslie sighed. Already working on that. But it was right around Thanksgiving. A lot of people left to visit relatives. We are, my flunkies are, confirming that people actually went where they said they did. So far, we found one wife who was supposed to be visiting her parents who was actually sleeping with a married man, and another who was in rehab. It is understandable that he told his work that he was taking an extended vacation. I promise I'll call when I get something or if I can get you in to talk to Mr. McDermott. They drove back to the Sonny's ranch about 2 hours after they left the show, only to find it deserted. Anna called Cage.
Chelsea's hanging out with Michael, Mackie, and the girl who was last place in Mackie's class, Cage explained, a smile in his voice.
Charles wondered why no one had called them to let them know that everyone was staying at the show, but Hostein had his family well guarded, even without Anna and Charles.
Mackie was feeling pretty bad, until she saw that the little girl on the chestnut was crying, Cage said. She gave her the same pep talk Hostein gives everyone. Did you do your best? Well, okay then. Any class where you don't end up on the ground is a good class.
Charles could hear the smile in Cage's voice.
Chelsea took them both to get ice cream with Hostein.
I told you not to worry, Charles said after she hung up.
If I were a fae trying to steal children, that horse show with all of its distractions would be just the place to do it, she said.
He'll have to get past Hostein, Wade, and the handful of werewolves working the crowd because they aren't going to be distracted from their job. And it's pretty public. So far, this one has gone out of its way to avoid detection.
Handful? Anna frowned. I only spotted two.
They mostly stayed out of range of your nose, he said. No use them running over the same places in the crowd we were already looking. If we didn't pick up on any fey, neither would they. But I know most of the people in Hostein's pack by sight.
Charles settled in with his laptop on the only chair in their room to work on pack finances. Just because the fey were out terrorizing Scottsdale didn't mean the rest of his work stopped. Anna pulled out a paperback novel with a half-naked man holding an improbably long sword. He wondered if the sword was meant to be metaphoric. Then he wondered if he should be concerned that his mate was reading a book with a naked man on the cover. Anna stretched out on her stomach to read. Her feet were toward him. Her position gave him a nice view when he needed a break from studying numbers, and he quit worrying about naked men. A couple of hours later, they heard a car drive up and the front door opened. The chatter of happy voices told Charles that the younger children were home, and so was Max. He didn't sound as happy as the kids. Charles was already logging off and shutting down his laptop when there was a quiet knock on their door. Anna hopped off the bed and pulled the door open.
Excuse me, Max said, but Granddad is down in the car and he's too tired to get out. Grandma sent me up to get you.
Charles brushed past him and leapt down the stairs. He was worried, though he knew that was ridiculous. Joseph was dying. He might die tonight, waiting for someone to help him out of the car. He might die a week from now in his bed. Ridiculous or not, Charles rushed out to the car where Maggie stood with the door open.
Don't you die on me, old man, she said. We have some fighting left to do.
And arguing, too,
Joseph said, the humor coming through the breathlessness just fine.
I told you we should go after Maggie's class, she snapped. But we needed to see how good that stallion Conrad's been bragging about really is. And then Lucy was riding in the amateur class on that filly she bought from us 2 years ago.
I know why you stayed, Maggie said, and it had nothing to do with Lucy's filly and everything to do with stupid pride. You couldn't admit you were feeling poorly. If she was yelling at him, Joseph was all right. As Charles bent down to lift his old friend, Maggie put her hand on his arm and leaned her head against his shoulder. He could all but feel her pain himself.
Maggie was always sharpest when she hurt. "Let's get you inside," Charles said.
"If I die after a day of watching beautiful horses, that would be okay,"
Joseph said. The spirits that seemed to be always hovering around Joseph, even if Charles was the only one who could see them, hit Charles so hard he could barely breathe. Their impact forced him to hesitate, stop walking altogether, and spread his legs a bit to keep his balance.
"You have a task yet," he murmured when he could. He headed for the house. "Let me see if they'll give you a little more strength to do what is necessary."
"Tell those spirits that if they want him so badly, they might cure his cancer," said Maggie tartly.
"It's worth my life to tell the spirits anything," Charles said. "You know better than to ask."
He was starting to get an odd notion about those spirits. The spirits who petitioned him were not human. They were spirits of the earth and air. That didn't mean there weren't spirits of the dead. Usually, the dead had a weight to them, a feeling of wrongness. The spirits surrounding Joseph burned with a purpose, a heat that made Charles's heart pound in his chest and called to Brother Wolf. There was nothing twisted or wrong in them. Still, this incident he and Anna were unraveling involved so many dead innocents. Children killed before they had a chance to decide who they were going to be. Unfinished. The innocent dead. He had only met one of those, and if Mercy, who could see ghosts better than anyone he'd ever met, had not been with him, he'd never have connected that spirit to the child who'd been killed on that stretch of road a dozen years before. Mercy had seen the boy quite clearly, but Charles had only felt a hot sizzle on his skin, like a sunburn, only deeper. Maybe this heat he felt from these spirits was like that child, only multiplied by all the dead who were owed balance because of the loss of their chance at life. Not rage, but vengeance. Still, what service could an old man dying of cancer provide for dead children?
"Charles?" Anna asked hesitantly. "Are you going to keep Joseph out here all afternoon?"
He wondered how long he'd been standing still. Without replying, he carried Joseph into the house.
"Anna," he asked, "could you come with me?"
He thought again.
"Maggie, it would be best if you stayed with Mackie and Michael."
"Where do you want me?" asked Max. "I know how to hook up all of Granddad's machinery." Max was like Samuel, Charles thought, a good man to have at your back, and he brought nothing with him that might change the nature of what Charles wanted to do. Maggie? He didn't quite trust what Maggie wanted. Maggie was never happy where she was, always looking elsewhere for happiness, for fulfillment. As much as she loved Joseph, and she did, she was not a restful person.
"Yes," he told Max. "Come with us."
Maggie looked at him with stricken eyes, and he felt as though he'd struck her.
"Strength and purpose are useful qualities," he told her. "But for what I'm going to attempt, we need quiet souls."
He didn't know if it was enough, but he left Maggie and the kids in the living room and headed up to Joseph's rooms. He and Max helped Joseph into the bathroom to take care of the necessities of living, while Anna pulled back the bedding and generally made herself scarce so as not to embarrass Joseph. Charles hadn't had to say anything to her. His mate was one of the most perceptive people he'd ever met. They laid the old man, who had once been one of the toughest men Charles had ever met, on the bed, and he struggled to draw breath enough to talk. It made Charles's heart hurt to see him this way.
"Shh," said Charles.
He looked around the room for something.
"I don't suppose there's still a cello around here someplace, is there?"
There used to be. Cage had played cello. Max frowned. "Actually, I think there is.
Cage's old cello is still in his room, here. Grandma makes him play it every Christmas. He starts sneaking practices in along about November. He says he doesn't take it home because it just sits there and makes him feel guilty for not practicing an hour a day like Grandma used to make him do. Hold on. As soon as he was gone, Anna said, "You want me to play?"
"We need music," he said, knowing it was true. "I think I need you to start it. And the cello is where your music lives."
"They're talking to you today," she said. "The spirits. What are they saying?"
"That's the problem," he said. "Usually I know exactly what they want me to do. All I have to do is decide if I'm going to accommodate them or not. This time, all I can do is follow my instincts."
"Good enough for me," she said, as Max came back into the room with a cello in a canvas carry bag. Anna took the instrument, stripped away the wrappings, and gave it a cursory examination. "New strings," she said as she tuned it. "Not a bad instrument."
She took the bow, rosined it briskly, and drew it across the strings. Her eyebrows rose at the tone.
"Better than I thought. Not as good as the one you got me, but it's better than most student instruments. Do you have a song in mind?"
"Something beautiful, but still upbeat."
He tried to put his feelings into words. She nodded, and then started playing.
"Lord of the Rings," said Max, startled.
Charles closed his eyes, listening, and it was all right. He raised his voice in answer to the cello, no words, just music, until the words became necessary. By that time, he was so lost in music, which he and Anna had morphed into their own song, that he didn't even know what language he sang in, let alone what the meaning of the words were. They were just a shape in the music he and Anna made together. The music built, and the power burned down his arms into his hands, so he placed those hands on Joseph. When it was over and the heat was gone, Joseph slept comfortably. The heat, the fire in his veins, was gone. The room was silent, and he knew that his earlier theory was right. For some reason, the dead, the children killed by the Fae who'd attacked the Sani family, were very interested in Joseph. That was something he wasn't going to share with Maggie and her very Navajo view of the dead. Maybe he should tell Joseph. He covered the sleeping man while Anna put the cello back in its case. Max took it without a word, and they all left, shutting the door quietly. Max started down the hallway, farther into the depths of the house, and stopped. He turned back to them and met Charles's eye.
"Anyone hearing that," he said,
"has to believe in magic." He left them. Anna took Charles down the hall in the other direction, toward the main part of the house.
"What did you do?" she asked.
"I have no idea," he told her. "I find that somewhat unsettling."
She took a deep breath, like an actress going on stage, pasted a big smile on her face, and said, "I find it somewhat reassuring that I'm not the only one who feels like I should be running around shouting, 'Where's the script? Where's the script? If I only had a script, I'd know what the freak I'm supposed to be doing.'" While Charles had been making magic, Maggie, Mackie, and Michael had made sandwiches for everyone since Ernestine had the day off. Maggie also made a huge effort at cheer for the sake of the children.
"Where's Chelsea?"
Charles asked. Anna remembered that Chelsea was planning on coming home with the kids.
"Terry ate something that disagreed with her, so Mom borrowed an outfit and she's going to take Terry's ride in the Western Pleasure Futurity Elimination Round," Max said.
"Anna Lee Hostine said she should," added Mackie.
"Eat," said Maggie, setting a giant plate of sandwiches down at the table where she'd already set a stack of dishes.
"What are your plans for the rest of the afternoon?" asked Max. "If you weren't too busy, Hostine suggested I take you for a ride around the ranch. He said to remind you that
You are guests, not guards. He had two of his pack follow us from the showgrounds. They're patrolling the grounds.
Anna looked at Charles.
Fine with me, he said.
What horses is Hosteen having you look at? Max asked. I left the list upstairs, Anna said. Let me go get it.
Anna and Mackie did the dishes while Max looked over the list with the pencil he used to make notes.
We could go out for a ride, Anna, he suggested when he was done scribbling. Merrylegs is here. We're not showing her at the big show this year. She's more of a trail horse than an arena horse, though she's not nearly as bad as Portabella that way.
And, Anna thought, it would get them out of the house and her out from under Maggie's glower. It was Charles who'd made her stay downstairs, so why was Anna getting the cold shoulder? Maggie hadn't so much as looked at her since they came down the stairs.
Okay, she had to be honest. She understood. She didn't like it. It upset her sense of justice. But she understood.
Charles had explained his reason for leaving Maggie downstairs, which Maggie could accept. But Anna had gone up with him and Joseph. Anna, young and werewolf Anna, had taken Maggie's place.
A ride sounds like fun, Anna said, and Charles nodded.
Can I come?
Asked Michael.
Sure, said Maggie. Mackie started to say something, but she looked at her grandmother and hesitated. Anna saw the moment she made the decision.
Grandma, I'm tired of horses today. I don't want to go for another ride.
You can stay with me then, Maggie said.
We'll go play some Candyland.
This time they tacked up their own horses while Max found saddles that fit and bridles that would work.
First time I ever rode a horse, I was 8, he told them, helping Michael brush the horse he'd picked for him, a short, stout, brown and white spotted half-Arab named Romeo.
Cage was dating my mom, and he was like, come ride some horses.
When she and I got home that night, I said,
you gotta marry him, Mom, said Michael. He has horses.
Max laughed. That's right, Pipsqueak. Maybe if I didn't like horses so much, Mom wouldn't have married Cage, and then you wouldn't even be around.
Yes, I would, Michael answered, because Daddy says I'm his penance for past sins.
Anna hid her grin as she picked up Merrylegs' foot to clean it. Merrylegs was a 7-year-old mare of indifferent breeding, Max's words, who'd come to the Sonnies as a training prospect. When her owner discovered boys, she'd turned over the mare's registration and ownership in return for back, board, and training fees.
She's sweet as pie, Max said. Not a show horse of any kind, but she'll try her heart out for you and take care of you. Mackie rides her a lot on the trails.
For Charles, Max brought Portabella.
She's on your list, Max said, and she's a fun ride on the trails.
Merrylegs, as promised, was sweet and responsive. She also had a trot that made Anna glad she'd inherited her mom's teeth and not her dad's, because if she'd had any fillings, they'd have been gone by the time the ride was over. Mary's canter was better, and her walk was brisk, but that trot was horrible.
Yeah,
said Max, though Anna hadn't said anything.
It's those really short and straight pasterns. She's like riding a jackhammer, but she'll canter forever, and her canter is lovely.
They rode past the hill where Anna had turned Portabella around the day before. Max led them on by it and out into the desert.
Okay, he said. You might as well see her strengths, right? And she's best out here where common sense and willingness mean more than pretty.
So they rode, and as a sort of camaraderie settled over them, Max gave Charles a half-shy look.
How did you meet Granddad?
He asked. Anna wondered if he was going to answer Max. He didn't often speak about the past unless it was important to something going on in the here and now. It was, Samuel had told her once, how the old wolves coped with the passing of time. Samuel was a lot older than Charles. But the magic of riding in the last of the afternoon sun, the smell of horses, and the rhythm of the ride had, she decided, caught him up in the magic of the shared experience. Or Maybe he didn't have the heart to shut Max down with one of his usual conversation-killing, two words or less answers.
I first saw him when he was about Michael's age, said Charles. Really met him when he was barely a teenager in a bar fight in Phoenix. It can be a hard thing to be a different color when men get together and get drunk. I was walking by, and I heard a war cry.
His horse snorted and shook her head. Charles patted her.
And then a whole lot of cursing and glass breaking. But it was the war cry that made me wade into that bar fight and start clearing it out. At the bottom of a pile of battered veterans, it was just after World War II, was this skinny little Indian kid of about 12 or 13.
Charles's face lighted with the sudden grin he had sometimes.
I said, takes a real man to hit a kid.
His grin widened. One of the guys, he was sporting the start of a real beauty of a shiner, he said,
Hell, mister, all I said was that he should get his butt out of here because he was too Indian to be safe with all the rough stock in here drinking like fishes. And the kid lit into me like I punched him.
Charles ran his hand down the shiny, long neck of his horse and then said,
Joseph never did have any quit in him, though he learned eventually to pick his battles. I'd been up conducting my father's business with Hosteen when someone told him that Joseph was missing. His mother had found out what Hosteen was and picked up and left. I guess Joseph overheard one of the hands saying that she'd probably run down to Phoenix to earn a living on her back in the bars there, which she hadn't. Hosteen had followed her all the way back to her sister's home out in the Four Corners area to make sure she was safe. But he told Joseph he wouldn't talk about her to him, and Joseph took him at his word, so Joseph didn't know where she'd gone. When he overheard the cowboys, he decided he couldn't leave his mother in trouble. So he stole one of the ranch trucks and drove it into Phoenix with the intention of finding his mother if he had to go to every bar in town to do so. When Hosteen figured out what had happened, and those two cowboys never worked on the Sonny's ranch again, he took the whole pack and me to Phoenix to find Joseph.
Charles was quiet for a little while, and Anna thought he'd finished the story, but he picked it up again.
So I looked down at that boy and said, Are you Joseph? He got to his feet, dusted himself up, wiped the blood off his chin, and said, Yes, I got 12 more bars to go. I said, You need to be more careful who you get your information from. Your mom is living with her sister over near Monument Valley.
That gave him pause.
While he was still thinking, I said, You need to remember one other thing. If you're going to face someone bigger and stronger than you, kid, make damn sure you were better armed. I gave him my knife and sheath. We stopped to give the bartender Hosteen's address so that Hosteen could settle the bill, because by my reckoning, it was Hosteen's pride that had caused the whole mess.
You used to run around with him, Max said. Cage said you and he got into a lot of trouble.
That was later, Charles said. Started, I suppose, when your grandfather was about 17. He'd run away again and was punching cows for a Navajo rancher. He and Hosteen locked horns over every little thing in those days. Hosteen asked if I'd stop and check in on him and see if I couldn't talk him into going home. Might not have worked. But he sent me out with an Arab Hosteen had bought from a breeder in California. Joseph could resist almost anything, except pretty mares.
That would have been in the 50s, right? Asked Max. Why were you on horseback?
The ranch was out in Navajo country, Charles said. I don't think there was anything with four wheels that could have made it there. I had a truck and horse trailer parked about 25 miles from the ranch.
He paused.
My Da and I were having trouble seeing eye to eye about then. He gave Joseph and me something to talk about on that trip back. I didn't go home. We worked Hosteen's ranch until the next fight. Then Joseph and I went out on our own, mostly working cows and increasing our cash flow with the occasional rodeo. Your granddad could ride anything with four hooves. On one memorable, almost fatal occasion, that included a moose. I think I have a photo of that one somewhere. If I find it, I'll send you a copy.
That's right when he met Maggie, right? Max said. Granddad says he was working at her ranch.
Charles huffed a laugh.
Her ranch was 200 acres of the nastiest country I've ever tried to run cows on. It had a spring, though, pure and clean and cold at high summer. We were at the nearest town, I don't remember the name of it, though it might come to me. Joseph and I had just finished up the fall roundup and were flush with money and time because we'd been let go, like most of the other hands, after the drive. She'd come into town driving a beat-up old truck to buy supplies and ran into trouble at the store.
Because she was Navajo? I mean, Diné?
Charles shook his head.
Most of the people there were Navajo. Diné, if you prefer. No, it was that she was a woman trying to be a man. That kind of attitude about women wasn't very Navajo, really. But it was very 1950s. Anyway, Joseph and I stepped in. Joseph being Joseph, it wasn't long before fists were flying, and Maggie was pretty good with her fists. She was smarter than the rest of us, though, because she hiked back to her truck and pulled out her shotgun. And that was the end of that fight. We worked for her all that winter.
He looked at Anna.
Not that winter in Arizona, except for the really high country, is very cold compared to Montana. I laid out that spring, but Joseph stayed and married her. I think she still owns that patch of ground, but they moved back here after a few years when Hosteen's dedication to the Arabians started to pay off and he really needed more help.
Why a moose? Anna asked. She'd seen a few moose since moving to Montana. Even the werewolves were wary of them.
You'd have to be male, 18, and trying to impress a girl to understand, said Charles.
Max laughed. 16 works, he said. First, Anna's phone rang, and then Charles's.
McDermott was a fetch, said Leslie, as soon as Anna answered the phone. I'm looking at a pile of sticks sitting in the chair where he was sitting not 10 minutes ago.
Charles, his attention caught by Leslie's conversation, answered his own phone, and though Anna could hear the voice on the other side, she couldn't understand a word he said.
English, said Charles. My Navajo was never that good, and I've hardly spoken it for 20 years. The Fae, said Joseph.
The Fae can look like anyone. She's here.
I'll get back to you, Anna told Leslie, and ended the call.
Chapter 14. Joseph Sawney woke up feeling as though he were 18 again. Nothing hurt. He sat up in his bed and wondered if he had died, and this was what happened afterward. But his body looked like the body of an old man, and his breath was still too short. He got up gingerly, expecting at any moment to feel as he had sitting trapped and helpless in the car. Aging, he knew, was part of living, a part of living that he'd chosen over the arguments of his father and his wife. That didn't make the frustration of being dependent easier, he'd found. But on his feet, his body was still obeying him, as it had not in years. Not only didn't it hurt, but he picked up a heavy potted plant that was set on the ground near the window. He had most of his old strength back.
There's something you need to do,
Charles had said, or words almost like that. Joseph wasn't a particularly spiritual man, not like Charles, his brother by choice, and mostly he'd been grateful for that. Men who saw the spirits had to listen to them, though Charles only listened to them when he wanted to. But even a man who wasn't spiritual could tell that something was up when the wear and tear of 80-odd years of life were lifted from him. It must be time for him to do that something. Too bad he had no idea what it was. Still, a man who was doing something ought to do it with clothes on, and an old cowboy who ought to do something would do it with his boots on, so he pulled out a pair of new jeans and set them aside for a faded and broken-in pair. He took out a good shirt, though, that snapped up the front like any shirt that belonged to a cowboy ought to. Cowboying was hard on the hands,
Any cowboy who handled ropes for very long soon had knuckles that didn't like fussing with tiny little buttons. After a moment's thought, he didn't put on a hat. This didn't feel like something a hat would help with. He took a good look at himself in the mirror in his bathroom.
"You are old," he told his reflection. But he didn't feel that way, not at all.
He tightened his right hand into a fist. He could still see the crooked finger that he'd broken when that four-year-old stallion decided to get the old Indian off his back. He hadn't stayed off and hadn't realized his finger was broken until 20 minutes later, when the adrenaline had worn off. That finger had hurt for 10 years, but it didn't hurt now. He turned away from the mirror and met the bright blue eyes of a little red-haired boy.
"The fae can look like anyone,"
the boy said.
"He's coming."
"Who are you?" Joseph asked, but the boy, who had been standing in the doorway of the bathroom, was gone.
"Jindy," said Joseph,
though the boy hadn't felt evil. Maybe he'd been imagining things, but he still was careful to twist around so he didn't go through the space where the boy had stood as he walked through the doorway back into his bedroom. He decided to go downstairs and find Charles. Charles would know the right questions to ask, maybe. He could at least expect that Charles would believe him. He stopped as he passed his chest of drawers and opened up the small drawer on the upper left side. And there was the old knife Charles had given him after rescuing him from a bar fight. It was a very good knife, 6 inches of pattern-welded steel. How good, he hadn't realized until 4 or 5 years later when someone had tried to buy it from him for $400. That had been at least 60 years ago. He had no idea what it might be worth now. But it was an old friend. Until very recently, he'd carried it every day of his life since the day Charles had given it to a skinny Indian kid with a chip on his shoulder. It took him a minute to find the sheath and belt. Dressed properly, he opened his bedroom door and started down the hall. Mackie and Maggie were playing Candyland. He could tell because Maggie exclaimed, "I get to go to Gumdrop Mountain," while Mackie cheered her on. That Mackie did not care whether she won or lost was not a fault of the game. Joseph thought that 20 years from now, when it was Mackie and not Cage competing in the rarefied atmosphere of the best equestrians of their generation, Mackie would still cheer on her opponents. For a moment, Joseph was deeply saddened by the thought that he would never get to witness that. But his time here was nearly past, and he really did not regret it. So much had changed, and so much had not. He was ready to go on a, how did Peter Pan put it, an awfully big adventure.
"I wanted to stay with you, Grandma," Mackie was saying, "but I'm worried about Michael. Nix is too tired to ride, and Michael is very little. Who do you think he's riding today?"
"I don't know," Maggie said. "Max knows the horses who will be good for Michael. One purple, your turn."
"Orange," said Mackie. "Do you think Anna will buy Merrylegs? I like Merrylegs."
Evidently, Max had taken his brother, Charles, and Anna out riding, Joseph thought.
"I hope she buys Hephzibah," said Maggie.
Joseph, unseen, still in the hall above the stairs, grinned. Mackie might not care about winning or losing, but her grandmother certainly did. If Anna had been what she had at first appeared, a too young, too innocent weakling, Maggie would have pitied her. But she would have taken her under her wing, too, and tried to teach her how to deal with strong-minded men. But Anna was, in her own way, as strong-minded as Maggie. The two of them would never have been able to be friends. Maggie would always view her as competition. That Anna had Mackie's appreciation of competition, except where Charles was concerned, didn't make Maggie like her any better.
"Hephzibah is pretty," said Mackie in a doubtful voice, "but Daddy calls her Hellbitch. I don't think Anna should buy a horse called Hellbitch, do you? It's okay, though. Max will help Anna find the right horse. Two Reds, it's your turn.
A car drove up outside. Joseph, who had taken a step forward, hesitated. He backed up a few feet and went into one of the guest bedrooms that overlooked the parking area. The car wasn't one of theirs, and it wasn't one he knew. He knew the woman who got out of it, though. Why was the owner, she could call herself a principal if she wanted to, of Michael and Mackie's daycare showing up at their door? The hair on the back of his neck stood up suddenly.
"She's here."
The soundless whisper was hot in his ear. He knew that the feds had the person they thought had hexed Chelsea and killed all those kids. He also knew that Charles hadn't been convinced. If he knew his father, and he did, Hosteen would have wolves watching the place. So why hadn't they stopped her? A fae can look like anyone. Maybe he could look like a woman, like the principal of Mackie's daycare. Instinctive certainty gripped him, and Joseph had learned to pay attention to his instincts. The woman approaching the house was the fae who'd tried to kill his grandchildren. Charles had told him that this fae had taken down a werewolf. Joseph remembered Archibald Vaughn. He'd been a big, mean, scary old wolf, and this fae had torn him apart. One old Indian wasn't going to stop him very easily. There was a phone in the bedroom. He picked up the receiver and dialed Charles's cell phone. As soon as Charles picked up, he told him what was going on. The doorbell rang as Charles said,
"English. My Navajo was never that good, and I've hardly spoken it for 20 years.
Downstairs, Maggie got up and went to the door. How well did the fae hear? Were they like his father?
"The fae," said Joseph in an urgent whisper. "The fae can look like anyone. She's here."
And then he had to hang up because the door opened. If she was here for Mackie, she would want to take her away from the ranch. One of the things that living with werewolves had taught him was that just because someone was supernatural didn't mean that cars didn't make getaways faster. He pulled off his boots and ran stocking-footed down the hall to the other end of the house. He slipped out the window, dropped onto the back porch roof, and